Okay, so here's my talk on nuclear power in space. And it's the real thing, actually. This is what it looks like when you have a 1 gigawatt nuclear reactor and put a rocket engine on top of it. And this is what it looks like when you test it. And I'm very sure that people here were all thinking that this is exactly the kind of technology that would get them to Mars in, I guess, the 1980s. As we all know, that didn't quite happen. Actually, this is more like the kind of thing that did happen. This is in current use, just a heater unit in this case, and you will find those in a lot of space probes. And what this thing is, this is the actual nuclear part. This is plutonium inside, and there's a little bit of platinum and other stuff coating it so you can touch it and you don't have any plutonium on your hands because this is plutonium 238. It's quite radioactive for very good reasons because the whole point about it is you want to heat something up. And if you want to heat something up, you better have it be really radioactive to have a good power output. Because it's so radioactive, you also have all these little shells here. This is essentially the same kind of material you would find on the space shuttle nose cone that can withstand the high temperatures of re-entry when it comes from orbit. And that's actually necessary to prevent it from just burning up in case something fails. This is really small. It has about 2 grams of plutonium inside of it, has a power output of 1 watt in terms of heat. And just for comparison, that's roughly what you have when you have your cell phone in your pocket and it's running some kind of program at full power. That's about 1 watt. It gets kind of warm, but you won't burn your hand when you touch it. Whole purpose for this is just to make sure that some components of the spacecraft don't freeze, especially batteries, because batteries cannot be recharged when they are frozen, when they are at some sub like 0 degrees centigrade or something like that. And you will find those in a lot of spacecraft. Like, for example, Galileo had 120 of those things. Cassini, besides the nuclear power source that we are just about to talk about right next, had 81 heaters, and the Huygens probe that landed on Titan, which is a really, really cold place. I mean, it's so cold you have liquid methane as lakes. That had 35 of those. And MER, that's the Mars Exploration Rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. They're actually just solar powered. I have a lot of solar panels on top of them and get their power from there. Still have 8 of those because they cannot afford to have the batteries freezing, especially at night. And they cannot simply use batteries to store power and run heaters overnight, especially in winter, because Mars does have winters and they're quite harsh. Same goes for Mars Pathfinder Sojourner. That was a little rover about this big, really small, that landed on Mars in, I think, 1996 or something, and still had 3 of them. This is what we are more likely going to talk about when it comes to nuclear power in space these days. This is New Horizon. That's the probe that visited Pluto. And power comes all the way from here. By the way, this dish is about 2.4 meters across. That's the diagram of the kind of radioisotope heat power generator that you would use, and it contains a lot of these modules here are not entirely consist they contain plutonium, but actually they also have a heat-resistant shell, so just in case this thing had a malfunction during launch and it would fall back to Earth, they could be sure it would not break up and break up and vaporize in the atmosphere. What you will find here is that they use thermocouples to generate power. That's one of the less efficient ways of producing power. Gets about 4% of the heat energy converted into electrical power, and you get a few hundred watts out of them. And it's not very efficient, but it's very long-lasting. The plutonium-238 has a half-life of about 88 years, which is a long time. But then again, keep in mind, it has, when it launches, it has maximum power and falls off. So the whole power is derived from the fact that there is nuclear decay going on. So the radioactivity itself is the power source. And that means that at the right at launch, when it's most dangerous, it's most radioactive. And that's why you better protect yourself against failed launches. Better ways to generate electricity out of heat, because that's all you do. You just heat something up. You have one side that's hot, you have one side that's cold, and thermoelectric elements do exactly that. They have one side that's hot, one side that's cold, and because you put it in between, you get electrical power. This is actually the same thing that happens in a Stirling engine like those. This is a very simple Stirling engine. You have a hot side, you have a cold side, you have a piston going back and forth in between them, and it's as simple as the piston taking hot air. This is the display, so it can push out and leave air in here. But it's not entirely tight, but it's also not like it doesn't have holes in it, so there can still be a force in between there. And essentially, gas here expands because it heats up and pushes it that way, and you can do it the other way around. Yeah, it's a Stirling engine. I can't explain it in 1 minute as it seems, but it's much more efficient. You get an efficiency of about 25%. So from the same amount of heat, you can get about 5 or 6 times as much electricity as from the thermocouples. The problem is you have a moving part. Moving parts are bad because everything that moves will eventually fail to move. It will get stuck. And there's nobody going to go up there with a bottle of BD-40 or something, put some grease on it, and make sure it starts moving again. This thing has to keep running. And they're able to keep it running for years at a time, but it's not quite as nice as the thermocouples. And that's why they have actually never been used in space so far. But there have been a lot of plans. Unfortunately, they have never materialized. They've never been financed. There are other ways to generate electricity. In this case, this was developed for, this specifically was developed for solar power, where you have something that's hot. Guess where this is coming from? The hot part is, of course, in this case, it's the sun in space. When you're far away from the sun, and nuclear power is only practical these days when you're really far away from the sun, so the sun is so far away you don't get enough power from it, you could use some kind of nuclear heat source because it's the only kind of energy source you can find out there. And you can construct emitters. Now, if you have a black body that's just emitting infrared radiation, you get something like this. This is the spectrum of the sun, and it's not very easy to efficiently generate electricity from this kind of spectrum. Because what a solar cell does is essentially, you go somewhere here, and everything that's over there is discarded. You cannot get any energy out of it at all. And it actually is only really efficient at this particular line that you choose, and you waste a lot of energy in the rest of it. Now, if you have something like this, and you can build an emitter that looks kind of like this, that has an emission spectrum that's similar to this by essentially changing the surface properties. You can just go here. There's nothing over here, and there's something in a small area over here, so it's more or less perfect. Now, it's not really perfect, and the actual concepts go up to about 30% efficiency, but again, you have no moving parts, so there's a great potential over here to develop something that can actually last for a long time without maintenance, which is exactly the kind of thing you want to have in a space probe that has to run for decades at a time. Now, where's the power coming from? Obviously, it's coming from radioisotopes. And almost all of them have been used. Exception is cesium. And what you can easily see is, this is the power you get for each gram of material that you have, is the shorter your half-life is, the more power you can get out of it. That's very easy to explain, because the half-life says how long it takes for all the stuff you have in there to radioactively decay. And if you have a short half-life, that means it decays very fast. Now, every single atom that decays releases a set amount of energy. And when you have a short half-life, a lot of atoms will decay in a very short time. Hence, you get a lot of energy out of it. And the more energy per decay you get out of it, the more power you can get. So the result is you have something like polonium-210 that was used by the Russians for the moon landers to keep them warm during the night. Nights on moon are about 2 weeks, roughly. Now, 2 weeks in absolute dark, no sunshine, it gets really, really cold. And you want to have a heat source, and that's what they used. Other possibilities are plutonium-238. Of course, the problem here is it has a really short half-life, but they just wanted to have a little rover to drive around on the moon for a couple of weeks, and that's exactly the kind of thing you want in this case. Mostly alpha radiation. Now, that actually plays a role. There are other possibilities, like strontium-90. Somewhat longer half-life than polonium, but shorter than plutonium. And yeah, you have beta radiation. Now, beta radiation also means you get some neutrinos. Neutrinos also take up some of the energy, so this value here is not actually quite true. The neutrinos take some of that energy away. And neutrinos just go through everything. They can go through planets, not just through the material in your battery. So they will not contribute anything at all to your heating. So a bit of this gets lost. Still, you can expect to get something like 1.8 watts per gram. That's quite a lot. Cesium is obviously a terrible choice because not a lot of energy, and the gamma radiation can also penetrate the material. It will not deposit a lot of energy within the battery, so it will not actually heat all of it up. But you still need shielding. You need a lot of shielding because gamma radiation, once it penetrates the material, it can penetrate you, and you don't really want that. Because, yeah, radiation is bad for your body, especially when you have a lot of it. That's why alpha radiation is preferred for those applications, because it can be shielded easily. It cannot even get through a piece of paper or something like that. Problem with alpha radiation is, if you have something like that within your body, it doesn't matter that you can shield it with a piece of paper, because you don't have a piece of paper within your body. So you really don't want to ingest it. Alpha radiation, once it's inside of your body, is some of the most vile stuff that you can have. So where does all that stuff come from? And the reason is, the point is, it's nuclear weapons, really. At least for polonium and plutonium. Within nuclear weapons, you want to have an ignition source during ignition, you won't have a lot of neutrons, and you can get neutrons from alpha radiation, and some from alpha radiation and some light atoms when you bombard something like beryllium with alpha radiation, you get neutrons. So polonium and later plutonium were produced specifically for the ignition source of a nuclear bomb. So necessary facilities were around, and then when people were looking for energy sources, they happened to find, oh well, those guys from nuclear weapons already have some nice isotopes that we could use, and so they used polonium and plutonium essentially. These others, like strontium, is essentially leftover spent fuel, so it's nuclear waste essentially, part of nuclear waste that can be used for this because it's, well, it's radioactive, guess what? And because it's radioactive, you can actually use the radioactivity to get some energy. Americium is very similar. Americium actually comes from the decay of plutonium 241, that's a beta emitter, so it can change to americium. And yeah, americium has a long half-life, but there's a lot of it in spent fuel. You can get it, and ESA, as far as I know, is trying to get some more of it. They're trying to develop a radioisotope energy source from americium, but so far they haven't done it. It has never been used in space. How do you get something like plutonium 238? Well, you can use neptunium, also part of spent fuel. You put the neptunium inside a nuclear reactor, it catches some neutrons, it turns into neptunium 238, I'm sorry, and that decays to plutonium. Very similar story. For polonium, it's easier. You just take bismuth and bombard it with neutrons, and it turns into polonium 210, essentially. Well, okay, so that is that. It's one way. It's not a particularly elegant way. It's very easy because all you need is the stuff. It hangs in there inside your battery, and it gets hot, and that's it. Nothing else required. It's really that simple, and that's why it's a really attractive option for something that just has to work. Those things have been used extensively also for satellites in the 1960s, like here for the transit satellites. Transit was an early navigation satellite, similar to GPS, just not quite as accurate. And this one in particular, Transit 5BN series, resulted in this thing. When you have something like Health and Safety Laboratory on top of it, and then something titled Global Inventory and Distribution of Plutonium 238 from SNAP 9A, which is the radioisotope heater that it used, something went wrong. And the thing that went wrong was this thing actually had a malfunction. The rocket that launched this actually had malfunction during launch, and it distributed about 1 kilogram of plutonium 238 in the atmosphere. And people thought, well, that's a bad idea. We don't want that to repeat. Actually, the amount that actually came down to Earth was rather limited, unfortunately. The result was something like that. The natural radioactivity in terms of alpha radiation was raised by 1/10,000th of the natural background. But still, people thought, no, we really don't want that. We don't want to repeat that. And that's why all the safeguards that I've shown you before have been implemented. And that's a good thing. Actually, even in the 1960s and 70s, people thought, yeah, we should be careful about this stuff. For example, during Apollo 13, they also had one of those sources on board, And yeah, Apollo 13, you all know what happened. It didn't quite reach the moon, and the radioisotope generator was supposed to land on the moon and stay there. That never got to happen, so it re-entered into Earth, and it never broke up, it never burned up, it plunged into the sea, essentially. And you can measure that, same way that you measured before with the SNAP 9A source. And that didn't happen. It worked. It really does work, and they really cared about that in the 1960s. Now, unfortunately, as we all know, still 1960s, there are different ways to get energy from nuclear power. A reactor, a real thing, and this is the real thing. This is about as big as the reactor is. The rest is just essentially in a nuclear power plant. This would be the cooling tower. This is a radiator that just gets rid of the waste heat. And this was also using thermocouples to get energy. It was really inefficient. Efficiency was 1.25%. This is a 40 kilowatt reactor. And it generated 400 watts of energy. It's really a huge waste of power, actually. But the thing worked. And the way it worked is, this inside here is the nuclear core. Those are fual pins. So this is the fuel rods that has the uranium inside of it. What you don't see here is liquid sodium that was used to cool it. And it was a pump up here. That pumped the whole thing around, because you have zero G, you have to find some way to move around your coolant, because you cannot use buoyancy or something like that. This moved the hot sodium to the thermocouples on one side, on the hot side, and on the cold side, it was cooled by those huge radiators. The pump itself used about one third of the power, or something like that, or one quarter, something of that size. And you can actually see how the whole thing works, because this here is our neutron reflectors. Chain reaction inside the reactor releases neutrons in all directions, and of course it's used within the fuel pins to split other atoms. But some of the neutrons escape. And when you have them like this, and they are open, they leave gaps, and a lot of the neutrons can escape. And then you can move these things around, and they will not leave gaps, and more of the neutrons will not escape and just come back to the reactor. And that's how the whole thing can maintain a chain reaction. And you can use this to control the reactor. These days, this is a modern paper. This is from, 2015, on this thing. This is the Krusty reactor core assembly. This is a hand here, just to show you. This is about 11 centimeters in diameter, about as big as a CD. You have a hole inside of here. Inside the hole, there will be a control rod. That absorbs neutrons. And actually, the design here is really elegant. There is no pump in here. It has heat pipes. Heat pipes, essentially, you have a heat source that's going to be the nuclear reactor. It will vaporize the sodium that's inside of it. And the vaporized sodium will go everywhere in the heat pipes, especially here to the hot side, where there are a lot of Stirling motors that will produce the energy. And it is going to condense here, because it takes away the energy. It's going to cool down. It's going to become liquid. And within the heat pipes, there's I forgot the English word for that. There's a wick. A wick that's the same thing that you have in a candle, that just uses capillary force to move the liquid sodium back to the core. So it all uses capillary force. It works in zero G. It doesn't require a pump. There's no pump that can fail. There's no pump that can that needs power. Really, quite an elegant solution for this kind of thing. Especially since with this reactor, this one failed within 43 days after an electrical failure, and they could, they had to shut it down, and they couldn't use the satellite anymore. Actually, a really interesting satellite that they used this on, because it had the very first ion engines on board. Actually, two types. I think one used mercury and the other used cesium. And they actually worked back in the 1960s. Of course, this one here is a mock-up. This is, as far as I know, this is uranium-238. The real thing that's actually being used right now, that's in testing right now, uses 90% enriched uranium with some molybdenum. That's essentially a well-proven technology from research reactors that's being used here. And you can see the heat pipes here. These heat pipes will just take the energy that's produced within the reactor, that's the heat in the core, away to the Stirling engines. That's how it's going to be done. And the neat thing about this kind of reactor is the reactor core itself cannot maintain a chain reaction. It's the same thing we talked about before. Neutrons from the reactor core escape, and because they escape, there cannot be a chain reaction. Not quite, anyway. And you need a good reflector to get them back inside the core, and that's here. And that core, that reflector, will be moved into the the core will be moved into the reflector, or vice versa. It's the same thing anyway. And without that step, the core cannot maintain any kind of nuclear chain reaction, even if you withdraw the control rod or anything. So it's actually it's about the safest you can get as far as nuclear reactors are concerned, especially at launch. One of the major problems people had with one of the major concerns people have with nuclear reactors is that during launch they may drop intact into water. And water is a really good neutron reflector, but it's not quite as good as this stuff. This stuff is beryllium, and so they essentially built this whole thing so that beryllium is just about enough, a good enough reflector to get a nuclear chain reaction, but water is not good enough to get a chain reaction. And so they can be really sure that if there's any kind of failure with the rocket and plunges into the sea, nothing's going to happen. This part here, the upper part here, is not part of the reactor. This is a vacuum chamber because they want to test the whole thing in vacuum. That's essentially just the test stand that they want to test it on. Okay, now back to the thing we were starting with. This is the 1960s. So what we've seen so far, this, by the way, this whole thing is a 4 kilowatt reactor. Really small. It's about the smallest kind of reactor you can find anywhere, and it will produce about 1 kilowatt of power. Just a reminder: the last one had about 10 times as much power and half as much energy, half as much electricity coming out of it. So a lot more efficient than what they used in the 1960s, and a lot less complex. All you really have to do is to move the reflector and move a control rod that will be inside the core out of it to start it, and then just leave it running. That's the plan anyway. They want to keep it as simple as reasonably possible to not have any kind of problems. Now let's get to the fun part. The fun part, in one way or another, depends on your kind of humor, is the 1960s. As I said, this is a 1 gigawatt nuclear reactor, and what they do is essentially they produce a lot of heat. A lot of heat, and we're talking about 2,000 degrees Celsius. and they heat up liquid hydrogen with it and push this out through a rocket nozzle. And the whole contraption is actually more effective than more efficient than a normal some kind of normal rocket engine, because actually what you do in a rocket engine is you burn one thing with another thing, it combines, becomes something heavier, and then you blow it out. Now if you remember your physics lectures, sorry. Yeah. Now, in physics, temperatures are essentially defined as the amount of energy that that each molecule of gas has. So, if you have really heavy molecules in a gas at a certain temperature, those heavy molecules will move slower than light molecules. And what you actually want in an efficient rocket engine is fast-moving molecules. And so you want to have the lightest molecules you can find, and that's hydrogen. And you heat them up really, really high, and you get something that's about twice as efficient as a regular hydrogen engine, where you burn the hydrogen with oxygen, and the whole thing suddenly becomes water, and water is about 9 times as heavy as regular hydrogen. So that's what it looks like. That's kind of like the idea from the inside, and it's very similar to every other nuclear reactor, actually. There's a shield here because you don't want to fry anything that's on the other side of the nozzle. Lots of nuclear, lots of radiation is released during the operation of the nuclear reactor because nuclear fission releases a lot of neutrons and hard gamma rays, and you want to shield this. There are control rods. Those control rods can be turned around. One side, in this case, one side absorbs neutrons, the other reflects neutrons. So this is a more efficient, much more efficient way to do this than the first reactor that I've shown, where you just open up the reflector. This one actually has an absorber on the other side. That's how you can control the operation of this reactor. It's quite involved, actually, because the thing you're trying to heat up is hydrogen, and hydrogen can moderate a nuclear chain reaction. It's the same thing that happens in, say, a light water reactor or something like that. And there you have water inside of the reactor that moderates the chain reaction. In this case, it's the same thing. And the thing that moderates the neutrons in water is the hydrogen. And here you have pure hydrogen, so it influences a lot about the chain reaction. And this actually had to be controlled, and you have to control this whole thing during the operation of the engine. And that was a lot of the reason why it had been tested, and tested quite a lot. I'm really sorry that this doesn't quite show up fully. I hope you can download the whole thing afterwards. Yeah, but we were in the 1960s. You remember what people did in the 1960s, especially in the US and USSR? They tested nuclear weapons. And I show these slides for good reason, because there's no way you can explain the next slide unless you keep in mind that this was what was going on at the same time. By the way, this is a nuclear bomb going off, as seen from Las Vegas. So there were cafes in Las Vegas where you could see tests of nuclear bombs going off. And yeah, okay, this is what it looks like when you construct a nuclear reactor in such a way that it is highly unstable, and where it can turn the control rods even faster. than you usually can, about 100 times as fast. And that's the kind of thing you really, really don't do to nuclear reactors without the nuclear reaction becoming essentially out of control. And that's what happened here. This is called, sorry, it doesn't show up completely. Kiwi TNT, the transient nuclear test. It released the equivalent of 2.2 tons of TNT. About 0.01% of the fallout was released here as during the very first nuclear bomb test. Yeah, that was done. One reason is they want to know what happens if this thing falls into water intact without falling apart before that. Because then, yeah, you have the same problem I was talking about before. Water is a really good neutron reflector, and it might go supercritical on you, and you don't want that. Or at least you want to know what happens if that happens. And the other is this little paper here, a comparison of nuclear and explosive destruct concepts for nuclear rocket engines. So if something goes wrong, you might want to blow up the engine before it can fall into water. And you will be happy to hear that they found out that, yeah, doing this with a nuclear explosion is actually a really bad idea. Why they did it, I don't know. I'm not really certain what they were thinking. They tested a lot of reactors, and to give you a size comparison, this is Kiwi B. That's the one that we saw before, 1 gigawatt roughly. That was A in the late 50s, 1960 had been tested already. Keep in mind, 1960, that was before anybody ever flew into space. And they were building them bigger. This one is Phoebus 2. That one actually worked, and it had been tested in 1967. And it was a 5 gigawatt reactor, and it ran at that power level. And I'm happy to report they really didn't care. They didn't care that the fuel in there broke up during operation. Actually, at the kind of temperatures you want to have here, above 2,000 degrees, there's essentially no material that will withstand this for any kind of time. And it will slowly erode. They've gotten better with time. At first, they broke up quite readily. Later, they had better materials, and the erosion rates came down, and a lot less radioactive material was released. But yeah, whatever was released came out of here and was released straight into the environment. So later you had tests like this one in 1972, and you will notice this one doesn't have 5,000 megawatts. This one has 44 megawatts. It's really small in comparison, so 100. And I've marked this one here. It was the only test ever with filtered exhaust. So this one was the only test they ever did, and with a really small reactor, about 1% the size of the largest reactor they tested, where they actually filtered the exhaust of the engine of the radioactive debris that came out of it. Yes, they really didn't care too much about the environment there. They were in the desert anyway, so I guess not too many people suffered from it, but it was a really bad idea. This was the first test that they did filtered, and it was, I think, as far as I know, this was the last test ever that was done with that kind of nuclear engines. And summer 1972, well, there was something in 1972. That was the last flight of the Apollo program. That's when they canceled the moon flights. And with the moon flights, they also canceled any plans to fly to Mars. And so they didn't need any kind of engine like this that's super efficient and might make it a bit easier to go to Mars. And yeah, that's when they stopped the program. Of course, none of that ever stopped anybody from having fun before that. and you know that kind of fun I mean. That was the kind of engine they proposed to use for the Mars flights, essentially. The thrust is about twice as much as the upper stage of Ariane 6. ISP is a measure of the efficiency, and it's essentially twice as high as a good hydrogen engine. Here's you can go look for this and find out a lot more about the whole program. It's essentially the same thing I already said. This one is the nozzle, so this is really the business end of the engine. This is the reactor core. There are the reflectors. Here's the shield that shields the rest of the rocket and the spacecraft from radiation. And those are turbo pumps. The turbo pumps are responsible for pumping the hydrogen into the core. I'm really sorry, but I copied this straight from a NASA document. And you all know what NASA is like. Yeah, they use pounds. They use pounds per square inch for pressures, stuff like that. And you can actually do some calculations though with this and show that they needed about 50 kilograms of hydrogen to be pumped through this reactor each second. And this actually requires quite some powerful pumps. And those pumps are actually also run from the reactor by taking some of the hydrogen they heated up through this line, as far as I know, and bring it back to drive some turbo pumps and keep the process running. Okay, there was a lot more fun being had, in theory at least. Because, you see, with that kind of engine, you have a problem. The problem is you want to heat up your hydrogen as high as possible. The higher you heat it up, the more efficient the engine becomes. Problem is, if you heat up the core any more than about 2,200 degrees or something like that, it's not just going to slowly erode, it's just going to melt, and then it's going to vaporize. And so you cannot use this kind of concept for that. But people had ideas. Criticality studies of a nuclear light bulb engine. Now, what's a light bulb? Light bulb sounds quite funny. How do you get a nuclear reactor with a light bulb? Well, let me tell you. You may have heard about uranium enrichment through gas centrifuges. Well, gas centrifuges means you have to have gas, and you can actually turn uranium into gas by turning it into uranium fluoride that turns into a gas quite easily. And you can make a reactor out of that. So instead of having some uranium rods or something like that, you have a gas. And of course, you can heat up your gas as high as you like. In this case, about 15,000 degrees. Now at 15,000 degrees, it will just glow. And it will not just glow as like the sun. This is actually three times as hot as the sun. So it will glow in ultraviolet light. And now they had the idea, okay, let's surround those chambers with quartz. Quartz is transparent to ultraviolet light. And then, so it can radiate out. The whole energy is radiated out as light. And then you put all your hydrogen along with some little particles that absorb the ultraviolet light and heat it up on the outside. And you can actually reach quite a lot higher temperatures and can get about three times the efficiency of the other engine with that kind of technology. I am happy to report, in this case, generally happy to report, this has never been tested. In theory, it should work. It really, really should. But it has never been tested, and I'm not sure it would be a clever idea to test that. Next thing. Even happier. The uranium. I mean, when you read something like uranium plasma, you know you're in for something. And the idea here is to have a plasma of uranium inside of the reactor, and have gaseous hydrogen on the outside of it and just not have any kind of quartz in between them, so you can heat up your hydrogen even more. The problem is, part of your uranium plasma will always escape along with the rest of it, so you will have radioactive exhaust. Quite radioactive exhaust, actually. This one, too, I'm happy to report, has never been tested or built. Again, here the idea is you have a critical mass on the inside, you have a neutron reflector, beryllium oxide in this case, on the outside, you have your nozzle, your rocket nozzle, somewhere here, you have a pump here, and that's the idea. The concept is quite easy. It has never been actually built, and if you want to build it, it's going to be a hell of a lot more complicated than that. Okay, last slide of this talk, second to last actually. When you see the word detonation, it's even worse than uranium plasma, I guess. This is actually from Zubrin. Zubrin is a guy who was looking for technology to go to Mars as fast as possible. And so he really didn't care. And his idea was, well, how about we have a supercritical mixture of uranium and water, but mix it with some kind of neutron absorber so it doesn't really get critical anyway here. And then you pump it out of the absorbers so it's just with itself and it can reach critical mass. You can pump it somewhere outside. You have some neutron reflectors in here. And the whole idea here is to have this so supercritical that it's inevitably going to have a chain reaction that's uncontrolled. But it's uncontrolled in a way that is, it's going to take a little bit of time until it gets out of control. And if you pump it fast enough, it will only get out of control once it is outside. And you have a nozzle on the left and right side of it. And so you can have a detonation and redirect the detonation to get your exhaust gases pointing away from your rocket, and it would actually be really quite efficient. I wouldn't want to be on board when you test this thing. Called nuclear saltwater rockets. It's real fun, I can tell you. At least as a concept, not as something you want to use. Oh yeah, one more. I almost forgot. Fission fragment nuclear reactors. This thing dispenses with the idea of heating up hydrogen. Why heat up hydrogen? Heating something up is going to be inefficient. Actually, you're splitting atoms, and when you split atoms, the two atoms that result will go in two directions at really high speeds. So how about using those two atoms coming out of the splitting of the atom to drive your spaceship? That idea had been developed sometime in the 70s, and this one is actually more current, sometime in the 2000s. And you essentially take those two atoms and redirect them with magnetic fields out of the engine, and you can, in theory, you could use this to get somewhere to 1% of light speed, with a fairly conventional. Almost conventional technology, at least in terms of physics, it's well known. Yeah, this is Project Orion, and if anybody wants me to talk about Project Orion, and you don't want to look it up yourself, well, be my guest. You can ask me otherwise. Thanks a lot. So, any questions? Okay.
Are you involved doing this kind of research?
No, not actually. Oh, but you can find a lot of papers on this on the internet. It essentially use scholar google.com and you can find all kinds of papers on these concepts. As soon as you start looking for them, you will find a lot of them in some detail. But I've been dealing with nuclear power for a long time. I've also dealt with spaceflight for a long time. So it's been a hobby of mine. So yeah, what can I say?
So thank you for the talk.
Yep.
You said that it's best to use a light propellant like hydrogen.
Yep.
But do I understand it correctly that if you use a heavy propellant, that the impulse is still the same, but the particles are slower but heavier?
Yes, but your efficiency goes down. The impulse is still the same, yes. But you need more. You need to throw a heavier mass out to get the same reaction on the other side. You see, if you have like 1 ton here and you have 1 kilogram of mass, and you shoot it on the other side with say 1,000 meters per second, your 1 ton mass will move with 1 meter per second in the other direction, right? You know, it's 1,000 meters per second in that direction, 1/1000th of the mass. So this one moves 1 meter per second in that direction. Now you try the same with 10 kilograms at 100 meters per second in the other direction. You still get 1 meter per second, but now you have wasted 10 kilograms instead of 1 kilogram. So, yeah.
So you just lose your propellant faster.
Exactly. And that means you cannot reach as high of a speed at the very end when you're out of propellant.
Was the cost of this actually competitive? If we put away all the environmental insecurity and stuff like this, just assume it works and there is no big contamination, but just it works.
Yeah. As far as I know, they spent about $12 billion in our money. Inflation adjusted, it's about $12 billion as far as I know. And they got to essentially to the point where they were ready to start building a working engine if anybody had said, okay, let's build one. So the R&D was finished more or less. To answer your question, actually not really, no. At least if you want to go to Mars, you can just use conventional fuels and just build a bigger rocket and you're fine. It was the 1970s, 60s and 50s, and they want to have as efficient an engine as possible, because they didn't just want to go to Mars, they also want to go further out,
other level, let's say, something which you can't absolutely not achieve with a conventional rocket, where you could say, okay, this is something if you want to go to, let's say, Alpha Centauri or something like this, where you can say, okay, this can scale up to some unlimited thing.
Not unlimited, but to the point of getting within 1 or 2% or something like that of light speed, yes.
Okay.
In theory. especially this thing. Also, I mean, this one here, like almost 10,000 seconds. That means it moves out with 100,000. Yes, 100,000 meters per second. No, that's not enough. You actually need that one because the atoms went from when you split uranium, the atoms move with some fraction of light speed. Just to give you a hint, the idea here is this is called the pusher plate, and you have a shock absorber. The shock that this is supposed to absorb is from a nuclear bomb. And the idea is to throw a nuclear bomb out here have it explode behind it, and use the push from the explosion to drive this whole thing forward. That's Project Orion. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You're riding on shockwaves of nuclear explosions. You can read up on it. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Thank you for the talk.
Yep.
And see you tomorrow. This is the last talk for today.
Thanks.